The stove didn't shudder as it adjusted to its heat. Denver wasn't stirring in the next room. The pulse of red light hadn't come back, and Paul D. had not trembled since 1856, and then for 83 days in a row. Locked up and chained down, his hands shook so bad he couldn't smoke or even scratch properly. Now he was trembling again, but in the legs this time. It took him a while to realize that his legs were not shaking because of worry, but because the floorboards were, and the grinding, shoving floor was only part of it. The house itself was pitching. Setha slid to the floor and struggled to get back into her dress, while down on all fours, as though she were holding her house, down on the ground, Denver burst from the keeping room, terror in her eyes, a vague smile on her lips. "God damn it, hush up," Paul D. was shouting, falling, reaching for anchor. "Leave the place alone. Get the hell out." A table rushed toward him, and he grabbed its leg. Somehow he managed to stand at an angle, and holding the table by two legs, he bashed it about, wrecking everything, screaming back at the screaming house. "You want to fight? Come on, God damn it. She got enough without you. She got enough." The quaking slowed to an occasional lurch, but Paul D. did not stop whipping the table around until everything was rock quiet. Sweating and breathing hard, he leaned against the wall in the space the sideboard left. Setha was still crouched next to the stove, clutching her salvaged shoes to her chest. The three of them, Setha, Denver, and Paul D., breathed to the same beat, like one tired person. Another breathing was just as tired. It was gone. Denver wandered through the silence to the stove. She ashed over the fire and pulled a pan of biscuits from the oven. The jelly cupboard was on its back, its contents lying in a heap in the corner of the bottom shelf. She took out a jar and, looking around for a plate, found half of one by the door. These things she carried out to the porch steps where she sat down. The two of them had gone up there. Stepping lightly, easy-footed, they had climbed the white stairs, leaving her down below. She pried the wire from the top of the jar and then the lid. Under it was cloth, and under that a thin cake of wax. She removed it all and coaxed the jelly onto the one half of the half a plate. She took a biscuit and pulled off its black top. Smoke curled from the soft white insides. She missed her brothers. Bugler and Howard would be 22 and 23 now. Although they had been polite to her during the quiet time and gave her the whole top of the bed, she remembered how it was before, the pleasure they had sitting clustered on the white stairs, she between the knees of Howard or Bugler, while they made up die witch stories with proven ways of killing her dead. And baby Suggs telling her things in the keeping room. She smelled like bark in the day and leaves at night, for Denver would not sleep in her old room after her brothers ran away. Now, her mother was upstairs with the man who had gotten rid of the only other company she had. Denver dipped a bit of bread into the jelly. Slowly, methodically, miserably, she ate it. Not quite in a hurry, but losing no time, Setha and Paul D. climbed the white stairs. Overwhelmed as much by the downright luck of finding her house and her in it as by the certainty of giving her his sex, Paul D. dropped 25 years from his recent memory. A stair step before him was baby Suggs' replacement, the new girl they dreamed of at night and fucked cows for at dawn while waiting for her to choose. merely kissing the wrought iron on her back had shook the house, had made it necessary for him to beat it to pieces. Now he would do more. She led him to the top of the stairs, where light came straight from the sky, because the second-story windows of that house had been placed in the pitched ceiling and not the walls. There were two rooms, and she took him into one of them, hoping he wouldn't mind the fact that she was not prepared, that though she could remember desire, she had forgotten how it worked, the clutch and helplessness that resided in the hands, how blindness was altered so that what leapt to the eye were places to lie down, and all else, doorknobs, straps, hooks, the sadness that crouched in corners, and the passing of time, was interference. It was over before they could get their clothes off. Half-dressed and short of breath, they lay side by side, resentful of one another and the skylight above them. His dreaming of her had been too long and too long ago. Her deprivation had been not having any dreams of her own at all. Now they were sorry and too shy to make talk. Setha lay on her back, her head turned from him. Out of the corner of his eye, Paldies saw the float of her breasts and disliked it, the spread-away, flat roundness of them that he could definitely live without. Never mind that downstairs he had held them as though they were the most expensive part of himself. And the wrought-iron maze he had explored in the kitchen like a gold miner pawing through pay dirt was in fact a revolting clump of scars, not a tree, as she said, maybe shaped like one, but nothing like any tree he knew, because trees were inviting, things you could trust and be near, talk to if you wanted to, as he frequently did since way back when he took the midday meal in the fields of Sweet Home. Always in the same place, if he could, and choosing the place had been hard because Sweet Home had more pretty trees than any farm around. His choice he called brother, and sat under it, alone sometimes, sometimes with Hallie or the other Pauls, but more often with Sixo, who was gentle then and still speaking English. Indigo, with a flame-red tongue, Sixo experimented with night-cooked potatoes, trying to pin down exactly when to put smoking hot rocks in a hole, potatoes on top, and cover the whole thing with twigs, so that by the time they broke for the meal, hitched the animals, left the field, and got to brother, the potatoes would be at the peak of perfection. He might get up in the middle of the night, go all the way out there, start the earth over by starlight. Or he would make the stones less hot and put the next day's potatoes on them right after the meal. He never got it right. But they ate those undercooked, overcooked, dried out, or raw potatoes anyway, laughing, spitting, and giving him advice. Time never worked the way Sixo thought, so of course he never got it right. Once he plotted down to the minute a 30-mile trip to see a woman. He left on a Saturday when the moon was in the place he wanted it to be, arrived at her cabin before church on Sunday, and had just enough time to say good morning before he had to start back again so he could make the field call on time Monday morning. He had walked for 17 hours, sat down for one, turned around, and walked 17 more. Hallie and the Pauls spent the whole day covering Sixo's fatigue from Mr. Garner. They ate no potatoes that day, sweet or white. Sprawled near brother, his flame-red tongue hidden from them, his indigo face closed, Sixo slept through dinner like a corpse. Now there was a man, and that was a tree. Himself lying in the bed, and the tree lying next to him didn't compare. Paldi looked through the window above his feet and folded his hands behind his head. An elbow grazed Setha's shoulder. The touch of cloth on his skin startled her. She had forgotten he had not taken off his shirt. Dog, she thought, and then remembered that she had not allowed him the time for taking it off, nor herself time to take off her petticoat. And considering she had begun undressing before she saw him on the porch, that her shoes and stockings were already in her hand, and she had never put them back on, that he had looked at her wet, bare feet and asked to join her, that when she rose to cook, he had undressed her further, considering how quickly they had started getting naked, you'd think by now they would be. But maybe a man was nothing but a man, which is what Baby Suggs always said. They encouraged you to put some of your weight in their hands, and soon as you felt how light and lovely that was, they studied your scars and tribulations, after which they did what he had done, ran her children out, and tore up the house. She needed to get up from there, go downstairs, and piece it all back together. This house, he told her to leave, as though a house was a little thing, a shirt waist, or a sewing basket you could walk off from or give away any old time. She, who had never had one but this one. She, who left a dirt floor to come to this one. She, who had to bring a fistful of salsify into Mrs. Garner's kitchen every day just to be able to work in it, feel like some part of it was hers, because she wanted to love the work she did, to take the ugly out of it. And the only way she could feel at home on Sweet Home was if she picked some pretty growing thing and took it with her. The day she forgot was the day butter wouldn't come or the brine in the barrel blistered her arms. At least it seemed so. A few yellow flowers on the table, some myrtle tied around the handle of the flat iron, holding the door open for a breeze, calmed her. And when Mrs. Garner and she sat down to sort bristle or make ink, she felt fine. Fine. Not scared of the men beyond. The five who slept in quarters near her but never came in the night. Just touched their raggedy hats when they saw her and stared. And if she brought food to them in the fields, bacon and bread wrapped in a piece of clean sheeting, they never took it from her hands. They stood back and waited for her to put it on the ground at the foot of a tree and leave. Either they did not want to take anything from her or did not want her to see them eat. Twice or three times she lingered, hidden behind honeysuckle. She watched them. How different they were without her. How they laughed and played and urinated and sang. All but Sixo, who laughed once at the very end. Hallie, of course, was the nicest. Baby Suggs' eighth and last child, who rented himself out all over the county to buy her away from there. But he, too, as it turned out, was nothing but a man. A man ain't nothing but a man, said Baby Suggs. But a son? Well, now, that's somebody. It made sense for a lot of reasons, because in all of Baby's life, as well as Setha's own, men and women were moved around like checkers. Anybody Baby Suggs knew, let alone loved, who hadn't run off or been hanged, got rented out, loaned out, bought up, brought back, stored up, mortgaged, won, stolen, or seized. So Baby's eight children had six fathers. What she called the nastiness of life was the shock she received upon learning that nobody stopped playing checkers just because The pieces included her children. Hallie, she was able to keep the longest, 20 years, a lifetime. Given to her, no doubt, to make up for hearing that her two girls, neither of whom had their adult teeth, were sold and gone, and she had not been able to wave goodbye. To make up for coupling with a straw boss for 4 months in exchange for keeping her third child, a boy, with her, only to have him traded for lumber in the spring of the next year, and to find herself pregnant by the man who promised not to and did. That child she could not love, and the rest she would not. God take what he would, she said. And he did, and he did, and he did. And then gave her Hallie, who gave her freedom when it didn't mean a thing. Setha had the amazing luck of 6 whole years of marriage to that somebody's son who had fathered every one of her children. A blessing she was reckless enough to take for granted, lean on, as though Sweet Home really was one. As though a handful of myrtle stuck in the handle of a pressing iron propped against the door in a white woman's kitchen could make it hers. As though mint sprig in the mouth changed the breath as well as its odor. A bigger fool never lived. Setha started to turn over on her stomach, but changed her mind. She did not want to call Paul D's attention back to her, so she settled for crossing her ankles. But Paul D noticed the movement, as well as the change in her breathing. He felt obliged to try again, slower this time, but the appetite was gone. Actually, it was a good feeling, not wanting her. 25 years in blip, the kind of thing Sixo would do, like the time he arranged a meeting with Patsy, the 30-mile woman. It took 3 months and 2 34-mile round trips to do it, to persuade her to walk one-third of the way toward him, to a place he knew, a deserted stone structure that red men used way back when they thought the land was theirs. Sixo discovered it on one of his night creeps, and asked its permission to enter. Inside, having felt what it felt like, he asked the red men's presence if he could bring his woman there. It said yes, and Sixo painstakingly instructed her how to get there, exactly when to start out, how his welcoming or warning whistles would sound. Since neither could go anywhere on business of their own, and since the 30-mile woman was already 14 and scheduled for somebody's arms, the danger was real. When he arrived, she had not. He whistled and got no answer. He went into the Redmond's deserted lodge. She was not there. He returned to the meeting spot. She was not there. He waited longer. She still did not come. He grew frightened for her and walked down the road in the direction she should be coming from. 3 or 4 miles, and he stopped. It was hopeless to go on that way, so he stood in the wind and asked for help. Listening close for some sign, he heard a whimper. He turned toward it, waited, and heard it again. Uncautious now, he hollered her name. She answered in a voice that sounded like life to him, not death. Not move, he shouted. Breathe hard. I can find you. He did. She believed she was already at the meeting place and was crying because she thought he had not kept his promise. Now it was too late for the rendezvous to happen at the Redmond's house, so they dropped where they were. Later, he punctured her calf to simulate snake bite, so she could use it in some way as an excuse for not being on time to shake worms from tobacco leaves. He gave her detailed directions about following the stream as a shortcut back and saw her off. When he got to the road, it was very light, and he had his clothes in his hands. Suddenly, from around a bend, a wagon trundled toward him. Its driver, wide-eyed, raised a whip, while the woman seated beside him covered her face. But Sixo had already melted into the woods before the lash could unfurl itself on his indigo behind. He told the story to Paul F., Hallie, Paul A., and Paul D., in the peculiar way that made them cry laugh. Sixo went among trees at night for dancing, he said, to keep his bloodlines open, he said. Privately, alone, he did it. None of the rest of them had seen him at it, but they could imagine it, and the picture they pictured made them eager to laugh at him, in daylight, that is, when it was safe. But that was before he stopped speaking English, because there was no future in it. Because of the 30-mile woman, Sixo was the only one not paralyzed by yearning for Setha. Nothing could be as good as the sex with her Paul D. had been imagining off and on for 25 years. His foolishness made him smile and think fondly of himself as he turned over on his side, facing her. Setha's eyes were closed, her hair a mess. Looked at this way, minus the polished eyes, her face was not so attractive. So it must have been her eyes that kept him both guarded and stirred up. Without them, her face was manageable, a face he could handle. Maybe if she would keep them closed like that. But no, there was her mouth. Nice. Hallie never knew what he had. Although her eyes were closed, Setha knew his gaze was on her face, and a paper picture of just how bad she must look raised itself up before her mind's eye. Still, there was no mockery coming from his gaze. Soft. It felt soft in a waiting kind of way. He was not judging her, or rather, he was judging but not comparing her. Not since Hallie had a man looked at her that way, not loving or passionate, but interested, as though he were examining an ear of corn for quality. Hallie was more like a brother than a husband. His care suggested a family relationship rather than a man's laying claim. For years they saw each other in full daylight only on Sundays. The rest of the time they spoke or touched or ate in darkness, pre-dawn darkness and the afterlight of sunset. So looking at each other intently was a Sunday morning pleasure, and Hallie examined her as though storing up what he saw in sunlight for the shadow he saw the rest of the week. And he had so little time. After his sweet homework and on Sunday afternoons was the debt work he owed for his mother. When he asked her to be his wife, Setha happily agreed and then was stuck, not knowing the next step. There should be a ceremony, shouldn't there? A preacher, some dancing, a party, a something. She and Mrs. Garner were the only women there, so she decided to ask her. Hallie and me want to be married, Mrs. Garner. So I heard. She smiled. He talked to Mr. Garner about it. Are you already expecting? No, ma'am. Well, you will be. You know that, don't you? Yes, ma'am. Hallie's nice, Setha. He'll be good to you. But I mean, we want to get married. You just said so, and I said all right. Is there a wedding? Mrs. Garner put down her cooking spoon. Laughing a little, she touched Setha on the head, saying, You are one sweet child, and then no more. Setha made a dress on the sly, and Hallie hung his hitching rope from a nail on the wall of her cabin. And there, on top of a mattress, on top of the dirt floor of the cabin, they coupled for the third time, the first two having been in the tiny cornfield Mr. Garner kept because it was a crop animals could use as well as humans. Both Hallie and Setha were under the impression that they were hidden. Scrunched down among the stalks, they couldn't see anything, including the corn tops, waving over their heads and visible to everyone else. Setha smiled at her and Hallie's stupidity. Even the crows knew and came to look. Uncrossing her ankles, she managed not to laugh aloud. The jump, thought Paul D, from a calf to a girl, wasn't all that mighty. Not the leap Hallie believed it would be. And taking her in the corn rather than her quarters, a yard away from the cabins of the others who had lost out, was a gesture of tenderness. Hallie wanted privacy for her and got public display. Who could miss a ripple in a cornfield on a quiet, cloudless day? He, 6-0, and both of the Pauls sat under brother, pouring water from a gourd over their heads, and through eyes streaming with well water, they watched the confusion of tassels in the field below. It had been hard, hard, hard sitting there, erect as dogs, watching corn stalks dance at noon. The water running over their heads made it worse. Paul D. sighed and turned over. Setha took the opportunity afforded by his movement to shift as well. Looking at Paul D.'s back, she remembered that some of the corn stalks broke, folded down over Hallie's back, and among the things her fingers clutched were husk and corn silk hair. How loose the silk, how jailed down the juice. The jealous admiration of the watching men melted with the feast of new corn they allowed themselves that night, plucked from the broken stalks that Mr. Garner could not doubt was the fault of the raccoon. Paul F. wanted his roasted, Paul A. wanted his boiled, and now Paul D. couldn't remember how finally they'd cooked those ears too young to eat. What he did remember was parting the hair to get to the tip, the edge of his fingernail just under, so as not to graze a single kernel. The pulling down of the tight sheath, the ripping sound always convinced her it hurt. As soon as one strip of husk was down, the rest obeyed, and the ear yielded up to him, its shy rose exposed at last. How loose the silk, how quick the jailed-up flavor ran free. No matter what all your teeth and wet fingers anticipated, there was no accounting for the way that simple joy could shake you. How loose the silk, how fine and loose and free. Denver's secrets were sweet, accompanied every time by wild Veronica, until she discovered cologne. The first bottle was a gift. The next she stole from her mother and hid among boxwood until it froze and cracked. That was the year winter came in a hurry at supper time and stayed 8 months. One of the war years, when Miss Baldwin, the white woman, brought Christmas cologne for her mother and herself, oranges for the boys, and another good wool shawl for baby Suggs. Talking of a war full of dead people, She looked happy, flush-faced, and although her voice was heavy as a man's, she smelled like a room full of flowers, excitement that Denver could have all for herself in the boxwood. Back behind 124 was a narrow field that stopped itself at a wood. On the yonder side of these woods, a stream. In these woods, between the field and the stream, hidden by post oaks, five boxwood bushes, planted in a ring, had started stretching toward each other 4 feet off the ground to form a round, empty room 7 feet high, its walls 50 inches of murmuring leaves. Bent low, Denver could crawl into this room, and once there she could stand all the way up in emerald light. It began as a little girl's house play, but as her desires changed, so did the play. Quiet, primate, and completely secret, except for the noisome cologne signal that thrilled the rabbits before it confused them. First a playroom, where the silence was softer, then a refuge from her brother's fright. Soon the place became the point. In that bower, closed off from the hurt of the hurt world, Denver's imagination produced its own hunger and its own food, which she badly needed because loneliness wore her out, wore her out. Veiled and protected by the live green walls, she felt ripe and clear, and salvation was as easy as a wish. Once when she was in the boxwood, an autumn long before Paul D. moved into the house with her mother, she was made suddenly cold by a combination of wind and the perfume on her skin. She dressed herself, bent down to leave, and stood up in snowfall, a thin and whipping snow, very like the picture her mother had painted as she described the circumstances of Denver's birth in a canoe straddled by a white girl for whom she was named. Shivering, Denver approached the house, regarding it as she always did, as a person rather than a structure, a person that wept, sighed, trembled, and fell into fits. Her steps and her gaze were the cautious ones of a child approaching a nervous, idle relative, someone dependent but proud. A breastplate of darkness hid all the windows except one. Its dim glow came from Baby Sugg's room. When Denver looked in, she saw her mother on her knees in prayer, which was not unusual. What was unusual, even for a girl who had lived all her life in a house peopled by the living activity of the dead, was that a white dress knelt down next to her mother and had its sleeve around her mother's waist. And it was the tender embrace of the dress sleeve that made Denver remember the details of her birth. That and the thin, whipping snow she was standing in, like the fruit of common flowers. The dress and her mother together looked like two friendly grown-up women, one, the dress, helping out the other. And the magic of her birth, its miracle, in fact, testified to that friendliness, as did her own name. Easily, she stepped into the told story that lay before her eyes on the path she followed away from the window. There was only one door to the house, and to get to it from the back, you had to walk all the way around to the front of 124, past the storeroom, past the cold house, the privy, the shed, on around to the porch. And to get to the part of the story she liked best, she had to start way back. Hear the birds in the thick woods, the crunch of leaves underfoot. See her mother making her way up into the hills where no houses were likely to be. how Setha was walking on 2 feet meant for standing still, how they were so swollen she could not see her arch or feel her ankles. Her leg shaft ended in a loaf of flesh scalloped by 5 toenails, but she could not, would not stop, for when she did, the little antelope rammed her with horns and pawed the ground of her womb with impatient hooves. While she was walking, it seemed to graze quietly, so she walked on 2 feet, meant in this 6th month of pregnancy for standing still. Still near kettle, still at the churn, still at the tub and ironing board, milk sticky and sour on her dress attracted every small flying thing, from gnats to grasshoppers. By the time she reached the hill skirt, she had long ago stopped waving them off. The clanging in her head, begun as a church bell, heard from a distance, was by then a tight cap of pealing bells around her ears. She sank and had to look down to see whether she was in a hole or kneeling. Nothing was alive but her nipples and the little antelope. Finally, she was horizontal, or must have been, because blades of wild onion were scratching her temple and her cheek. Concerned as she was for the life of her children's mother, Setha told Denver, she remembered thinking, well, at least I don't have to take another step. A dying thought, if ever there was one. And she waited for the little antelope to protest. And why she thought of an antelope, Setha could not imagine, since she'd never seen one. She guessed it must have been an invention held on to from before Sweet Home, when she was very young, of that place where she was born, Carolina, maybe, or was it Louisiana? She remembered only song and dance, not even her own mother, who was pointed out to her by the 8-year-old child who watched over the young ones, pointed out as the one among many backs turned away from her, stooping in a watery field. Patiently, Setha waited for this particular back to gain the road's end and stand. What she saw was a cloth hat as opposed to a straw one. Singularity enough in that world of cooing women, each of whom was called ma'am. Setha, ma'am, hold on to the baby. Yes, ma'am. Setha, ma'am, get some kindling in here. Yes, ma'am. Oh, but when they sang, and oh, but when they danced, and sometimes they danced the antelope, the men as well as the ma'ams, one of whom was certainly her own. They shifted shapes and became something other, some unchained, demanding other, whose feet knew her pulse better than she did, just like this one in her stomach. I believe this baby's ma'am is going to die in wild onions on the bloody side of the Ohio River. That's what was on her mind, and what she told Denver, her exact words. And it didn't seem such a bad idea, all in all, in view of the step she would not have to take. But the thought of herself, stretched out dead, while the little antelope lived on an hour, a day and a night, in her lifeless body, grieved her so she made the groan that made the person walking on a path not 10 yards away halt and stand right still. Setha had not heard the walking, but suddenly she heard the standing still, and then she smelled the hair. The voice saying, "Who's in there?" was all she needed to know that she was about to be discovered by a white boy, that he too had mossy teeth and appetite, that on a ridge of pine near the Ohio River, trying to get to her 3 children, one of whom was starving for the food she carried, that after her husband had disappeared, that after her milk had been stolen, her back pulped, her children orphaned, she was not to have an easeful death? No. She told Denver that a something came up out of the earth into her, like a freezing, but moving too, like jaws inside. Looked like I was just cold jaws grinding, she said. Suddenly, she was eager for his eyes, to bite into them, to gnaw his cheek. I was hungry, she told Denver, just as hungry as I could be, for his eyes. I couldn't wait. So she raised up on her elbow and dragged herself. One pull, two, three, four, toward the young white voice talking about who that back in there. Come see, I was thinking. Be the last thing you behold. And sure enough, here come the feet. So I thought, well, that's where I'll have to start. God do what he would. I'm gonna eat his feet off. I'm laughing now, but it's true. I wasn't just set to do it, I was hungry to do it, like a snake, all jaws and hungry. It wasn't a white boy at all, it was a girl, the raggediest looking trash you ever saw, saying, look there, a nigger, if that don't beat all. And now the part Denver loved the best. Her name was Amy, and she needed beef and pot liquor like nobody in this world. Arms like cane stalks, and enough hair for four or five heads. Slow-moving eyes. She didn't look at anything quick. Talked so much it wasn't clear how she could breathe at the same time. And those cane stalk arms, as it turned out, were as strong as iron. You about the scariest-looking something I ever seen. What you doing back up in here? Down in the grass. Like the snake she believed she was, Setha opened her mouth, and instead of fangs and a split tongue, out shot the truth. Running, Setha told her. It was the first word she had spoken all day, and it came out thick because of her tender tongue. Them the feet you running on? My Jesus, my. She squatted down and stared at Setha's feet. You got anything on you, gal, pass for food? No. Setha tried to shift to a sitting position, but couldn't. I like to die, I'm so hungry. The girl moved her eyes slowly, examining the greenery around her. Thought there'd be huckleberries. Looked like it, that's why I come up in here. Didn't expect to find no nigger woman. If there was any, birds ate 'em. You like huckleberries? I'm having a baby, miss. Amy looked at her. That mean you don't have no appetite? Well, I gotta eat me something. Combing her hair with her fingers, she carefully surveyed the landscape once more. Satisfied nothing edible was around, she stood up to go, and Setha's heart stood up too at the thought of being left alone in the grass without a fang in her head. Where are you on your way to, miss? She turned and looked at Setha with freshly lit eyes. Boston, get me some velvet. It's a store there called Wilson. I seen the pictures of it, and they have the prettiest velvet. They don't believe I'm gonna get it, but I am. Setha nodded and shifted her elbow. Your ma'am know you on the lookout for velvet. The girl shook her hair out of her face. My mama worked for these here people to pay for her passage, but then she had me. And since she died right after, well, they said I had to work for 'em to pay it off. I did, but now I want me some velvet. They did not look directly at each other, not straight into the eyes anyway. Yet they slipped effortlessly into yard chat about nothing in particular, except one lay on the ground. Boston, said Setha, is that far? Ooh, yeah, 100 miles, maybe more. Must be velvet closer by. Not like in Boston. Boston got the best. Be so pretty on me. You ever touch it? No, miss. I never touched no velvet. Setha didn't know if it was the voice, or Boston, or velvet, but while the white girl talked, the baby slept. Not one butt or kick. So she guessed her luck had turned. Ever see any? She asked Setha. I bet you never even seen any. If I did, I didn't know it. What's it like, velvet?